Grading is often an assimilating tool. It is a way to get kids to behave in a very white dominant culture norm. When we include behavior in the grade, we disproportionately punish students who are different from the teacher.
Hi, I'm Shane Safir.
And I'm Alcine Mumby, and this is Street Data Pod, where we dream with you about next generation schools that affirm, love, and value every learner.
Here we have conversations about healing, hope, and listening at the margins. Podkin, we are back for season four. So happy to be back with you and kicking off a new season where we're going to explore foundational pedagogies as we look at different connections between a pedagogy of student voice and the street data framework. We're really interested in this season in street data being in dialogue with other books that have shaped and influenced the field. For the first episode of season four, we get to talk with my friend and almost neighbor just down the street, Joe Feldman, author of the amazing Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms.
Joe is an English and U.S. history teacher in Atlanta Public Schools, a high school assistant principal in Manhattan, a high school principal in D.C., and then worked in the central office back in New York City with small schools. He was also the director of curriculum and instruction in Union City, California. He now leads Crescendo Education Group, which since 2014 partners with schools and districts to help teachers improve their grading practices to be more equitable, more accurate, and motivational. His writings about equitable grading and assessment have been published in Education Week, Kappen, Education Leadership, and Black Press USA. He lives in Oakland with his wife and two children. Welcome to Street Data Pod, Joe.
Hello. It's so great to be with both of you. You're so thoughtful and good people, and you've had all these like luminaries on, and I get to like hitch a ride.
Yes. You're a luminary in your own right.
You are. And not only are you a luminary, you are our first white male on our podcast. Share with us who you are, the identities that you hold, and how you have come to your beliefs and stances around equity as a white guy.
So I guess I'll talk a little bit about kind of the professional journey and then a little bit more personal. So, you know, as you said, I was a teacher in Atlanta Public Schools. I was hired the day before school started. I didn't know what course I'd be teaching the first day. I, you know, ended up teaching all kinds of different classes as I was filling in for a long-term sub kind of role. And saw in that school the ways in which schools were not serving the kids very well, or even getting to know them, much less serve them. And then decided that, well, if I wanted to make changes in schools, I should do it through force, really, because people weren't willingly giving kids what they should be getting. And so I went to law school and instantly was disappointed in the pedagogy and found that, you know, not everybody was there for social justice and to make improvements in the world. And so started looking at different ways I could combine law and education, and worked with the Manhattan superintendent for a while and worked for a civil rights firm and felt like I need to be back in schools. And then I moved to California and worked in a district where we spent the better part of 2 years getting rid of the prerequisites to enroll in honors track classes in the high school, and made it where students could opt in instead of being required to demonstrate whatever. And I think all those things just got me very aware to the way that systems and structures, often unbeknownst to the actors inside them, are doing things that you know, take away humanity from children, that prevent them from accessing opportunities.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to meet my wife in one of the schools. She's a Black woman and our children are mixed race. And I think it is, you know, it's helping me on a daily basis have a better understanding of what it is like to not be white, frankly. And spend a lot of time listening and just trying to, you know, understand. And things affect me more directly, you know, when my kid has something happen in the school, Well, sure enough, like, how is that system operating in ways that are, you know, working against them? And how do we think about that? And they actually experience it. And, you know, I think a lot of times the burden is on people of color to sort of the burden of proof to, like, no, this is actually happening. And, you know, sometimes white people hear it and sometimes they hear it. They're like, nah, not really, because it's not happening to me. And I think it's just helping me really see it happening, because it is happening to members of my own family. So I don't know. I think all that is just kind of both those kind of experiences and who I am now sort of come into this.
Yeah.
And I'm also Jewish. I was raised Jewish, and now is, you know, there's a lot to talk about what it means to be a Jewish American and a Jewish progressive. And, you know, we have those kinds of conversations at home too. And our kids are interdenominational, I guess, right? So they've been to temple and synagogue. We don't go that frequently. And we've also been to church, and we don't do that too frequently. But it's helping me better understand what it means to be in those spaces myself. So it's just so much I'm still learning about and still thinking about.
So, Joe, you wrote this best-selling book, Grading for Equity, published by Corwin, as well as my book, and our beloved Dan Alpert, who's just retired and broken my heart, but is just the most amazing human and editor. And we wanted to start with brass tacks and invite you to define for listeners what you mean, first of all, just by grading, and then what you mean by equitable grading or grading for equity. Like, what are some of those practices and mindsets that keep educators from pursuing this path of equitable grading?
So I'll start with defining grading. So it's where there is a formal feedback about where students are in their learning. I think that sometimes people think, well, if you're graded, it must be A through F. Or if you're graded, that means that somebody is essentially like controlling or punishing you or telling you what you're capable of. And I think that is just because that's how many of us have experienced it and that's how it's been. But I think it's actually where kids just know where they are in their learning in some formalized way.
Right. I heard that word formal really popped out at me, like that being the key criteria, not the metrics or the letter grades, but like the formalization of a feedback system.
That's right. And formal doesn't necessarily have to be at the end of the term. It doesn't have to be summative, right? It's just where we are looking at something that we're teaching you, and we're looking at what we want you to be able to know and do based on that. And we're going to tell you where you are relative to that.
Got it. Okay. So then what's equitable grading? What does grading for equity mean?
Right. So grading for equity is where we look for key characteristics of that grading system. So first of all, it has to accurately describe where students are in their learning, which seems so self-evident. But grading most of the time in most classrooms is not accurate, as strange as that sounds. And, you know, we can talk about why. Just to reference what I was saying about systems, like, I think that there is so much of the grading, traditional grading system that teachers have inherited and that has been replicated since the Industrial Revolution, that people have never been given the opportunities to critically interrogate that system. And once they have access to start to interrogate it, they recognize the flaws and inequities in the system. So it's not only accurate, it's also bias resistant. So it's where the grades that we assign, the ways that we describe where students are in their learning, is resistant to the biases that we have as individuals in, you know, as human beings. And it also is counteracting the institutional biases, the disparities in resources and opportunities and the way that other systems are working to prevent students from being successful. We are trying to do things in our grading system that counteract those other systems.
So active disruption.
That's right. That's right. And the third is where it's motivational. So in contrast to traditional grading, where grades are, and points in particular, are used very much as like an extrinsic motivation. I'll give you this carrot or I'll hit you with this stick.
Yeah.
it is around how do we build the capacity and agency and intrinsic motivation of students to understand what's being asked of them, to own the more aspects of the process of learning, of the assessment process, so that they become invested in their own learning and invested in their own success in ways that traditional grading really go in the opposite direction and tell students that you can't be successful unless you do exactly what I say, and many of you won't be successful anyway. So it's trying to be those three things.
I just wonder if you could speak to a few signature practices or mindsets that you think keep folks from pursuing this path.
Well, I mean, I think there are things that prevent teachers from going down the path that are often independent of the practices. I think teachers feel very protective of their grading practices for really legitimate reasons. I think that in so many ways, teachers have so many mandates placed on them and so much power and agency taken away that grading is one of the few islands of autonomy. I write about this, that it is where they have total control and discretion. And it is really the mark of their professional judgment and expertise. They are in the best position to grade than anybody else. Now, we can talk more about students' role in that, but ultimately the teacher is in that best position. And when we talk about ways in which they may be inadvertently undermining their own work and perpetuating achievement and opportunity disparities, like that is very jarring to them. And I think a lot of teachers don't want to go into that space because it will force them to come to terms with the fact they may actually have been harming students unbeknownst to them. They may have actually been harming them. And so I think there's a real challenge in getting them to start this work. And what I think has really been the most helpful is to, and you all know this in your work, is to normalize those reactions, to normalize that they've been doing the best that they can. Teachers invest an incredible amount of time in refining their grading practices, right? And they really think so deliberately about them. And it's all okay. Like now they can do better because they know better. And giving them license to do that, I think is what's important. You know, and I think it's everything from using the 0 to 100 scale, not grading behavior, not including behavior in the grade, right? All these non-academic or even kind of soft skills, right? For all kinds of reasons. And that's very difficult because it means giving up some control, right? A lot of teachers use grading as a classroom management strategy. And so if you're now telling me I can't use grades to control behavior, what am I going to do? Like that's my go-to to get students to do what I want, right? So it's asking them to kind of give up some of that kind of power. They get power also from equitable grading, but they also have to give up some of it. So, you know, I think all those are two ways. I think that just, it's so hard for so many teachers to do this, but once they start doing it, they find that it's just amazing for them. It's transformative in their classrooms. It changes how they think about teaching. Teachers have even said, like, this, as strange as this sounds, changing my grading brought joy back into teaching, because no teacher goes into teaching in order to grade.
Yeah. And we also have zero training on it.
That's right. Teachers get no training in professional education programs. I mean, they're starting to get a little more now where they'll read like a chapter maybe of the book or an article. So it's more than before. But we've even seen where teachers who do this work actually are more interested in staying in their district. So it's having an impact potentially on teacher retention because it connects them to why they went into the work.
One of the things that popped out as you started to talk about the formal aspects of grading was really how equitable grading is getting us back to focusing on learning, not the proxies of learning, not what we think learning is, not the compliance that we think we need to get in order to achieve learning. But it really is, if you do this well, it makes you think about what is the learning you value in your classroom and how do your grades communicate that learning. And I just remember how, you know, I started teaching at Fannie Lou where we had report cards and all these other equitable ways of thinking about it, where it was totally transparent. The kids knew these were the assignments that would be in your grade, and this is how this is going to factor. We also had rubrics. We had these other things. So I also think about how what you're calling for is more transparency to everyone involved in this learning system and this learning endeavor around what actually constitutes the grade that they're getting. That, I might add, as a high school person, becomes the thing that a kid gets, you know, like holds up at the end of their 12th grade year, their transcript, which is full of grades, right? And so I'm just thinking about how this is really a call for us to really, really embody equity in real intangible ways that impact learners' lives and the learning that we hope for them to have.
I talk about it as lifting the veil. So often, you know, we might think as teachers that we're being transparent. Like, I'm telling you, 40% is for homework. Like, it's very clear and I'm putting in all the numbers and it's all there, but that's not transparency. That's translating something into a numerical system, which is not the same as transparency. Mm. Transparency is simplicity and clarity and explicitness, right? This is what I want. I'm helping you learn to do. This is what it will look like when you can do it. Here's some common gaps. You know, this is very much a rubric and proficiency scale development. And now by making that explicit, I now have democratized power in the classroom and knowledge in the classroom, right? So, and Shane, you talk about this, where how can we have it where if everybody knows what the goal is, what the target looks like, now the teacher is not the arbiter and the sole judge of quality, right? Now, again, like they obviously have more experience in it and, you know, they've studied this in college. And, so I get that part. But how can we help students see explicitly? So now it's not the teacher, it's not the student who has to please the teacher, which is a very sort of lopsided power dynamic. Now the student and the teacher are on the same side and they're both looking together at the target, shoulder to shoulder at this target, right? So it totally changes what a classroom feels like and what a teacher needs to do in a class and what, who they need to be.
I'm curious, you named a couple of ways in which we fall into those potholes or we touch that third rail, which was also a different analogy that you used in your book. But I'm curious, what are some concrete ways educators can center student voice as they reimagine grading alongside assessment?
One is reimagining the relationship between the student and the teacher around the assessment process. And I, you know, I was just talking about, you know, how do we position teachers on the same plate next to the student around this to you know, preserve the original Latin root of it. It's also, I think, taking a more of an inquiry stance into how might be ways that students can demonstrate what they have learned. So I think we as teachers feel we are bound to and constrained by the assessment tool that we choose to use. And so, you know, I want a student to show me what they know. I'm going to come up with this assessment, a test, multiple choice, whatever. And hopefully the student shows me what they know because that's what I'm using. That's what I'm grading. That's the score I'm putting in the grade book. And it's very much like I am bound and held to whatever score the student gets. And in the work that I do, it's helping teachers ask a question before entering it in the grade book, which is the data that I'm getting in this assessment valid?
Yeah.
Do I think that this is actually showing me validly what that student knows? If the answer is yes, I can put something in the gradebook. And if not, or if I have some doubt, maybe I don't put it in the gradebook because why would I as a teacher put invalid data in the gradebook, right? If the student did wonderfully in this discussion we had yesterday when we were reviewing, and then they did terribly on the assessment, the exam that I gave, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would I put in that student score if it's invalid?
Yeah.
So it asks us to open up the aperture of assessment and say, okay, what might be multiple ways that we could ascertain what this student knows and then calibrate it across, right? Triangulate that data to have more confidence in what that student knows, because that's the grade I got to put down. And now if I'm going to open up this aperture, maybe the student can help tell me. Maybe the student and I together can figure out what are some ways that they can best communicate to me and give me insight into what's in that brain of theirs, because my grade, it should reflect accurately what's their level of knowledge? And so it's partnering with them even around assessment design potentially.
Yes.
So I am very curious to hear from you how you see grading for equity in street data in conversation with each other. Chapter 5 of Street Data outlines a pedagogy of voice, which is the focus of the next book that I'm writing for Corwin. And one of those, you might recall, one of the 6 simple rules there is feedback over grades. And you're my primary citation there. But, you know, on a larger scale, like how are these books in conversation in the field and hopefully kind of tag teaming to help teachers?
The pedagogy of voice, about really thinking about what are authentic ways to know what students know, and that the way that we grade would reflect that, is so important. And it's not only important in the final grade, you know, in the final number or letter or descriptor that you use in the report card, but it's throughout the process. So, you know, how can we not include behavior in the grade?
Yes.
So part of our work when my organization partners with schools and districts is that we interview students and ask them about their grading experiences. And this is something that I think teachers should just do. You should find ways to find out how your teachers have experienced grading. But oftentimes they tell us that classrooms are performance spaces, that they have to be perfect all the time, that, you know, they're graded on everything. They're graded on, are they on time? Do they raise their hand? Do they ask a question? Do they contribute to a discussion? Do they have their homework? Do they have their notebook ready? I mean, all these things. And it's exhausting for them and dehumanizing for them, that they need a space where they can learn. And you cannot learn, and Sarita Hammond talks about this, right? You cannot learn if you are in a state of stress and anxiety. And so many of our grading systems do that and hide the humanity of our students and dampen it and prevent it from even coming out, right? It is not a space to learn. And I think that teachers get very nervous when we say, well, you know, you can give feedback on behavior, right? If somebody's a knucklehead, like, you can let them know that, and you can talk to them about it, and you can, you know, figure out what to do. And like, you, there are lots of ways you can give people feedback on their non-academic work. And by not including those things in the grade, it gives them the space to make mistakes, to have a bad day, to like share with you what's going on for them. If we can think about grading in a much more thoughtful way and decide what's in the grade and what isn't as a real question, then I think we can start to open up more of those voices for them.
Joe, you mentioned being a father to Black children. And so I'm curious how, in all your work and your research, what you have to say about the ways in which grading disproportionately impacts, you know, Black children in particular, but also neurodivergent children, children who historically and currently are underserved by our current educational system. Can you say a couple of things around that in particular?
We've gotten better, I think, in our schools in thinking about disciplinary policies and looking at the disproportionate punishments of Black children, and particularly girls, Black girls, and other students of color, and the way that our policies have a particularly disproportionately damaging impact on neurodivergent children or, you know, other LGBTQ folks. But we haven't really thought about it in the context of grading. And what we see is that from traditional grading practices, grading is often an assimilating tool. It is a way to get kids to behave in a very white dominant culture norm, whether that be like how I sit in the classroom or when I speak or how I speak or my affect that may just rub the teacher the wrong way or be unfamiliar to them or they misinterpret, right? All those things, when we include behavior in the grade, we disproportionately punish students who are different from the teacher.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about that, especially in the context of participation, right? And how kids participate. And the ways in which we think that, like, making eye contact and, oh my gosh, don't get me started on, I used to have to teach teachers how to get kids to slant for all day in some of the schools that I worked in as an administrator, where they have to sit up. And that's their stance as they're supposed to be engaged in learning and hold their body in a very unnatural way of being, right? And how you found those strategies disproportionately in schools with Black children.
All the ways that we have tried to turn students who aren't white, aren't in the dominant culture, into those ways of being historically, right? This is way back, Industrial Revolution, with all the immigrant populations that we had, right? Very much like, we are going to mold you to be ready for a particular kind of way of being in the world we want to create, or in the world, in the ways that the world is apparently demanding you to be. We're going to kind of participate in that, and participation grade is for that. And I think when teachers stop doing that, they actually open up a lot more space in the class.
What do you believe needs to be said about pedagogy and student voice to help educators transform their practice? And what's missing in the literature and the discourse?
I, again, go back to something I said earlier, which is around control. I think teachers struggle with, one is control, and then I'll talk about a second thing. One, just that students would learn and follow directions and, contribute to the class positively without grading them on it seems so foreign. And it asks the teacher to kind of just let go. And that's very difficult for so many teachers, I think, to believe, actually. I think the other is just feeling like it's possible, like they actually have the power to do it. And I mentioned that a minute ago, but Tanji Reid Marshall talks about teachers' instructional power, and that they actually have agency and power over the ways that they choose to grade, and recognizing that and feeling that, and when they make those changes and there's success around it, like that virtuous cycle of efficacy and agency, I think is such a great result that teachers don't even imagine is possible for them, unfortunately. And this is a little, this tiny little lever of an aspect of the grading, which seems so small. Like, nobody thinks grading is something worth talking about, because it's just, I just add up the points. It's in the grade book. The software produces it. That's it. But it's just these tiny little things can, in a change in a system, has all these ripple effects, which, it goes to how powerful systems are, and when we can change them, amazing things happen. And so I think that's the other part of that struggle.
What do you feel like is the connection between these two themes you've talked about, the control / letting go and the feeling like it's possible? You've given the example of grading as a pivot point, or a lever. What about teachers' desire to fill up the room with their voices, and the willingness to allow or actually even organize the classroom around student voice and dialogue? Are those things connected? Are they unrelated?
Yes, they're related. I really recognize that teachers are doing the absolute best they can with the ways that they grade. They haven't had any training. They are really trying to create this model of classroom management, culture building, incentivizing, right? All these things. They want positive classroom communities, right? The most amazing, progressive, liberatory teachers oftentimes will still use the 0 to 100 scale, right? And inadvertently be undermining so much of what they believe and what they're trying to do. And I think that, for the teacher who wants more student voice and wants to, getting students in the room to play a greater role in what that room is, grading can help do that. When you start to think about what is, and like I said, what is and what isn't in the grade, how transparent it is, whether there are redos, right? Are there opportunities for redemption? when mistakes are made, right, in the grid. I mean, all these kinds of things open up that space.
So also in Chapter 5 of Street Data, we offered an agency framework that's really trying to orient the field toward a new way of thinking about success at a student level. But whenever I teach people about it, I talk about how that agency framework has to be symmetrical for adults. So exactly what you just talked about. We have to also be thinking about welcoming and, you know, measuring, if you will, identity, belonging, mastery, and efficacy for adult learners and educators, as well as for students. And, you know, so just as we sort of move toward a close here, I'd love to hear you think out loud about how equitable grading and assessment doesn't just improve student experience, but actually transforms teacher agency and teacher identity, right? Like, who am I in this work? Maybe even belonging, you know, a sense of belonging in the profession. Like, how do those things intersect with this process you're describing?
Teachers are facing so many responsibilities and dehumanizing aspects of their work, both because of the pressures and the external perception and the salaries. And, you know, we could go on, and the working conditions, we go on and on and on. I think that there's also a powerless that teachers are even taught, that I think that oftentimes they are taught, and this is the, like, you know, ways of teacher education and teacher professional development that are very much like, well, here's the notebook, here's the binder, like, just do the things. There's no agency, right? You're just supposed to faithfully implement what we have told you to do, right? That's the job. And, you know, and even in our workshops that we do, teachers will say, well, like, I understand you're talking about the theory and the history and the why, but, like, I just, like, tell me how to do it. I just want to know how to do it. And we're very resistant to that because it doesn't have them own and understand and sort of then be able to translate and mediate that into their own classrooms. I think that when teachers are given those opportunities to be thinkers, to be creators, to be adapters, right? And when they get student voices to help them do that, I think they feel like I do have efficacy. I do belong here. Like, I'm able to have, like, a whole self here. When we do it collectively, now we have this collective efficacy. We are sharing with each other and hearing from each other and learning with each other. And that actually makes for the best ways that I can do that with my students, because just like with teachers, you know, if I'm not graded on my group work with my teachers, it is an integral part of me being better at a teacher, right? To be in this place. And so I'm going to create these same kind of conditions for my students to give them agency and them collaborative joys and peer learning and understanding, right?
All right, we're gonna keep trying to improve our lightning rounds. All right, you want to kick us off, Alcine?
Sure. All right. So, Joe, you are called to listen deeply to someone, but what they have to say is triggering. What's the first thing you do?
I think I appreciate their question. I say, or I appreciate what they have to say. Like, I'm glad you brought that up. I think it both buys me time and, like, lowers some of the pressure in the room.
All right, lightning round number two. What is a practice, a ritual, or just a way of being in the world that keeps you grounded in the struggle for educational justice?
Humility and curiosity.
Yeah, ooh, good one. What is one form of street data that every educator should gather?
When a student had an experience that caused them to believe that they could do better the next time.
What would you call that kind of experience?
Redemptive one?
Wow. A redemption moment.
Yeah. I think we underestimate hope in our classrooms. We way underestimate hope.
Wow.
Oh.
That's amazing.
That's so beautiful. Yeah.
Okay. Conversely, what is a type of data that you feel is overused?
Participation.
What's one essential feature of your vision of like a classroom?
I'll go again with redemption as an essential feature of the humanity of that classroom, both for the teacher and the students.
All right, last one. A great learning experience will, if you could complete that sentence.
I think contribute to feelings of self-actualization and efficacy and capacity. Like what I said earlier, like a great learning experience just makes you believe that you can do better. You actually believe it. Like, I will be able to do better.
Thank you for this conversation, Joe. You've been a joy.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you. This was great. Thank you for all your great questions and the conversations that you're having with each other and with other folks. It's just, I appreciate it a lot.
Street Data Pod is executive produced and hosted by Shane Safir and Elsie Mumby. The senior producer is Maya Cueva, and our production manager is Jamie Valle. Becca Bantam is our social media coordinator, and Alice Lopez is our production assistant. A special shout out goes to Rocky Rivera for our theme music.
If you want to get a copy of Street Data, visit Amazon, Corwin Press, or better yet, a local independent or Black-owned bookstore. At Corwin's website, use discount code STREETDATA, all caps, to get 20% off. If you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. And if you found us rambling or fumbling over our words, remember, we can't be articulate all of the time. You have raised the bar for white men coming on the show.